This is The Conversation.
It's episode 124 with Allison Kuo. She is a New York-based artist specializing in food, particularly food performances. And yes, it is a fun one. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. Go check it out for images that go along with this podcast, including Allison's recent performance at Motel in Brooklyn. You will also see some other very exciting images that go along with that, and you can access all past episodes through the Conversation Pod. Last episode was with artist, gallerist, and galler artist Austin Thomas, and I can see that's a popular episode, so maybe you've already listened to it, but in it we talk about the challenges of being a gallerist and artist and collaborating with artists. We talk about her visions for a different kind of art world, a more community-based art world, and how she's done that through her Pocket Utopia gallery / alternative space. And Austin talks about how she and her husband wound up buying property in Manhattan rather than Williamsburg, because that's what the banks were willing to get behind. So it's the story of how she became a Manhattan rather than a Brooklyn resident. Good stuff. So go check that out. Allison Kuo and I talk about how she lives in Manhattan, and she, of the New York guests that I've had recently, is the third straight guest in a row to be a Manhattan resident, which is, I think, quite interesting. We talk about her recent performance, some of her other performances, including Serve Me a Drink, what it's like being part of the expat Texas community in Manhattan and New York, and her blog, Accidental Chinese Hipsters, which is linked through the site. Go check that out as you're listening, and I hope you enjoy, and I will talk to you on the back end. Thank you very much for being here.
I'm ready.
Beautiful. I guess a great place to start, as I seem to be starting often with people in New York or the East Coast, is where are you? And then I say, are you in Brooklyn?
I am in my apartment. And that I share with my boyfriend in the financial district. So,
oh wow, you're in the city.
I am not where you thought I would be.
Yeah. I don't know why I had that idea necessarily. I guess that's just an easy assumption to make. So you're my second New York guest in a row that lives on the island. How about that?
Yeah.
So you're close to all the well, I mean, let's be realistic or create an accurate picture for people who either haven't been to New York much or not at all. You know, you obviously have the Wall Street area, which includes Wall Street itself, and then the big firms that are around there. But then what else do you have, and how close are you or far away are you from that, would you say?
I live about 3 blocks south of Wall Street in the Stock Exchange and the Bull and all of that stuff. And it's also one of the older neighborhoods of New York. So there are a lot of great old buildings around, like the Delmonico's and Francis Tavern, where George Washington used to get drunk. and it's pretty close. It's basically the southern tip of Manhattan. So
right.
It's right next to the seaport and the water. There's no one around at nighttime. All the people, finance people leave. So it's really quiet, close to the World Trade Center.
That's great, actually. In fact, I remember somebody who lived down where you are many years ago describe it, that, you know, that everybody's gone. So everybody's still gone. Everybody heads home to their respective neighborhoods in the evening.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is hard to get people to come hang out with me down here.
Why?
But I feel like once you come to the financial district and you see it and you realize that it's not like a horrible place, it grows on people very quickly, but there's definitely a stigma attached for New Yorkers, and especially for artists.
Right.
I get a wide range of reactions from people when I tell them that I live in the financial district, but I love it. And my studio is in Williamsburg, right in the middle of all of the kind of hipster central area of Williamsburg. So
right.
I get to go to Brooklyn still. I like Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you just had this. I wanted to give people a little location context, but you just did this performance just last week. So why don't you give us all the gory details?
All right. Well, it was a performance for a newer gallery in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn called Motel. And they wanted to kick off the year with a month of performances. So I did the first one. And when they invited me to do it, I knew I wanted to do a new piece. So I went to the gallery and checked it out. And as I was walking around the neighborhood, I saw this Chinese restaurant across the street, just like a takeout place that was really drawing me in. So I went in and I checked it out. I took a menu. And when I was taking the subway home back to Manhattan, I was just thinking like, oh, it has to be about this restaurant, Jin Guang. So at first I wanted to cook in the gallery, and I've had a lot of mixed experiences with that before. So I decided, no, why would I do that? The restaurant makes the food. And a lot of my work, I do performance with food.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a repertoire now of different ways to make it into sculptures, or, make it kind of painterly, or just like a fun experience where people are watching me take food that they recognize and turn it into something, you know, glittery and spray painted. And, so I just asked people to go to the restaurant Jin Guang and order something off the menu and then bring it to me in the gallery, which is across the street. And then I would do my thing to it and give it back to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. It worked out.
How many people participated approximately?
I would say, you know, not everyone who came to the show was willing to go get the food, which is fine. Because I wanted to kind of make people do something.
Mm-hmm.
But I probably did about 30 plates. And I did have a friend there helping me when it got a little busy.
Mm-hmm. When you mentioned a little earlier about doing earlier performances where you're cooking food, right? That that for me, and I imagine for a lot of people, brings to mind Rikrit Tirvanya, you know, who sort of was kind of an early artist in this sort of artist collaborative, artist participation. Collective? What's the word I'm looking for? I'm actually kind of blanking.
You're going to make me blank now.
Yeah, yeah. we're both blanking. But it's, you know, he was one of the early guys to one of the first
relational aesthetic.
Thank you. Yes. He was.
I completely hate that term.
Yeah. Yeah. It's horrible, but absolutely. Just like I kind of hate practice. so in any case, the reason that I mention him is because he did come to mind, but obviously from your description, you have a very different angle, but has it always been that way when you're cooking in a space?
Yeah, I think it's always been pretty different. Although, you know, I think what Rikrit did was really incredible. It's not so much that the idea of simply preparing something that, something that I would do at home in the gallery is what I'm sharing with people, but it's more for me about pushing people a little bit to see how far that they would go, you know, in a playful way.
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, even just accepting something from someone they don't know is enough. And I can't really, you know, say, okay, here's a potato chip, eat it. That's as far as they want to go. And other people, they're the ones who take it really far. And they want to eat the most disgusting thing that you could put together, or they want something elaborate, or they want me to feed it to them. And I just enjoy that. I actually have a background in teaching English as a second language, and that's when I kind of got started in performance work, because I had a classroom full of adults every day for 4 hours or 6 hours, and I had to figure out what to do with them. So we started doing a lot of weird activities together, and I really liked it.
Right, right. Yeah, that's great. That's makes a lot of sense that this is kind of how you've evolved. It's like, how do I connect with people? And sort of the other thing I was thinking about is just food is just everywhere, you know. You've got cable TV, you've got Instagram, you know, and you obviously have a podcast as well. I mean, it's so many people are just so obsessed with food, and you're making art about it, basically. Or maybe a better way to put it is you're using food to make art, maybe about connection.
About connection, but also about food. And I think about representations of food and what I find to be, you know, maybe ridiculous or fun about the way that people represent food. One of the things that I really like about New York or other big cities are, you know, as you walk around, you're passing by bodegas and restaurants, and they all have these graphics on the outside of the food that they offer, and, you know, absurd landscapes where you have buildings and bottles of Tide and Pepsi and sandwiches flying at you. And
there are
watching commercials and seeing the shrimp slow motion dip into the sauce flashing out at you. I just can't get enough of that kind of thing.
Is your some of your shtick kind of a play on food porn? Like you're taking food porn even further than one would think it could go?
Yeah, definitely. And that's something else that I grew up in the suburbs of Dallas, and my dad's Chinese, so the best food to me was always going to like hole-in-the-wall Chinese places, and Chinese food is not really known for being very nice to look at in the first place. So when I first, you know, as an adult got exposed to gastronomy or even just nicer restaurants, it was really confusing. Like, there's not much food on the plate. I don't understand why this is, you know, this is terrible.
So have you been
to eat here?
Have you been to molecular gastronomy restaurants like WD-50 and places like that?
Yeah, I did. I did get to go to WD-50 once before it closed, and it was incredible. I loved it.
Do me a favor. Tell me and people listening, because I've never been to that or other well-known molecular gastronomy restaurants. Tell people what that experience is like.
So you would usually, you know, kind of plan in advance, and you would get like a prefix menu. So you have kind of a set course of the evening. It's very orchestrated and theatrical. And you might have 5 courses or 10 courses, and a lot of them are maybe 5 bites of food, but they come out, you know, the presentation is beautiful and each ingredient is described to you. And for something like WD-50, the most memorable dish for me was scrambled eggs and bacon, but the scrambled egg was a perfect cube of scrambled eggs that was somehow fluffy on the inside. And then the bacon pieces were so tiny, you almost couldn't see them, but they were really flavorful. And, you know, yeah, I mean, it's sometimes it really blows you away. And then sometimes it just seems like people are doing things, you know, in an absurd presentation, just because if it's in a cylinder or if it's in a gel or a foam or a gas, then it's, you know, I think that there is a side of molecular gastronomy that is kind of like, it feels like it came out of a laboratory.
Right.
And it's kind of cold. And I don't think that's as exciting as WD-50 had this kind of more raw, like playful nature. So that's why I like that one.
Was the reason for their closing? Do you know?
I know that he opened a new restaurant also in the Lower East Side in New York. But it's probably just rent. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be back with something else.
Right. And when you went there, do you roughly how long ago was that?
Maybe 4 years ago.
Okay, the reason I ask is I'm wondering if you're sitting there taking pictures throughout the whole meal.
I really try not to do that
right
when I'm eating. I feel like it's important to, when you're presented with food, number one, the way that the chef wants you to experience it is the way it is when it comes out. So if you wait, then it doesn't taste as good. But mm-hmm. it also just, it really takes me out of the moment to take pictures of it.
Right. Yeah, of course it does. It's just that, you know, I have to ask, you know, anybody who's doing that kind of experience. I mean, I think the odds, if you or just any random person had gone to a restaurant like that within the past year or so, the chances that they would have been taking some pictures are higher than they were even 4 years ago.
I feel like it's almost rude to do that. Mm-hmm. If, you know, other people around and they can see you, it just, I went to the David Bowie Memorial after work yesterday just to, like, you know, I wanted to, like, light a candle. And mm-hmm. I got there, and there was a police barricade. His apartment in Soho was next to an American Apparel storefront. So
right.
there was that, and there was a police barricade in the line, and everybody was just waiting to take pictures of the same thing.
Right.
And I feel like we have the internet now. You don't need your own picture of that. But, like, I wouldn't go to someone's funeral and wait in line to take a picture of them.
Yeah.
Not that I've never taken pictures of my food. Sometimes I can't help it. But I feel like I usually want to do it more like I'm traveling or...
Sure.
You know, if there's just something that, like, a presentation or, you know, it's something crazy that I know I'm never going to see again. But...
Yeah, and when you're working so... you know, regularly with food in your work, taking pictures of food when you go out to dinner or what have you just seems like overkill.
Yeah, I'm going to go to my studio and dunk plastic toys in it and take pictures then.
So right. There you go.
I have enough.
Yeah.
And I do. When I started working with food, I was taking some cooking lessons from a friend who's a private chef. Mm-hmm. In exchange for some design work. And he was complaining about how, you know, people take pictures of their food and they don't take a good picture and then they put it on the internet and then that's what people think your food looks like.
Right.
So
right.
I was like, okay, I'll just avoid that.
A couple of your earlier pieces that I think really might resonate with listeners from a sort of narrative anecdotal level because they're so evocative, I think, just in description alone, are, and maybe you can pick one that you sort of had the most interaction with, but there's make you a drink and then make you a sandwich, right? And just to give people a visual, something to picture in their head, you are the one doing serving, right? So there was this... pattern white screen and mm-hmm. a pair of colorful sort of like pajama almost like arms with yellow plastic gloves at the end of them hanging through the other side, and somebody is sitting there and you're making them a drink and they basically just see the disembodied arms. Is that about right?
That's it. Yeah.
So what what were some of the takeaways from either or both of those pieces?
Actually, make you a sandwich. I built the sculpture and then realized that I wasn't quite ready for the performance and that it would be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So that one actually only was a sculpture. But make you a drink, I've done in a few different places. And I like the idea of the sort of disembodied service and my struggle in having to make this actually was not something I was expecting to be kind of the best part, but I think that's what people responded to the most, because when I would make the drink, they can't see me, but I also can't see what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the first time I did it, I was making a cocktail that was vodka and candy in this sort of like candy goo. And I was pouring people full glasses of vodka. And it tasted disgusting. Mm. But
so you were kind of abusing them on many levels.
Yeah. But some people liked it fine. And I did it again recently in a show in the lounge of an apartment building that these MFA students had, you know, just they lived in this weird apartment. And they said, okay, well, we'll just do a show on Friday night and hope it ends before it gets shut down by the cops. Mm. So I was in the corner I was making pumpkin spice cocktails with pumpkin out of a can and chartreuse and club soda and cinnamon and candy corn. So, you know, all these materials are just kind of splattering on the floor. I think my gloves got so slippery at one point. I shot the bottle of club soda out and almost hit somebody. And I was actually kneeling on this like wooden stool the whole time. So it was like kind of painful for me, but that was what they liked the most. And, I also just think it's funny, like having an illusion that's so obvious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The screen is not very wide.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just, you know, step a quarter turn to the right, you can see me behind
it. Right. You know, it made me think a little bit about, it made me think of somebody like, I don't know, Benny Hill for some reason comes to mind. There's, you know, the way you're describing that kind of unfolding with all its sort of goofiness, wackiness, and slickness.
Yeah, I really like the Marx Brothers.
Mm, mm-hmm.
I don't know, I had a tape of Duck Soup when I was a kid, but
mm-hmm.
the scene where he's, I think there's like a hot dog cart or something.
And right.
He keeps cutting off the guy's tie and putting his leg in his arms.
I just remembered that, you know, that you mentioned you're from Dallas, and I wonder if, despite your complete lack of accent, if there's something occurred to me a moment ago, something in the bigness of Dallas or, you know, Texas that comes across that's connected in your work somehow. Does that make sense?
What do you mean by bigness?
Well, Texas bigness, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it is. I mean, here, let me start again. Dallas, because I had a conversation with a LA artist who's from Dallas quite a while ago, but and just sort of wackiness, you know, everything from Kennedy conspiracy theories, you know, on forward. There's just actually he is a guy that was kind of friends of people involved in this project, for lack of a better word, called Hot Tub Mystery Religion. And I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but
you're really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I was obsessed with it for a while. So some of your work seems to, I think it's, you know, an over the top kind of quality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of your work has an over the top kind of quality.
Bigger in Texas.
There you go.
That reminds me of I had this drawing club that started when I lived in Texas, and I actually was mostly kind of Texas expats in Brooklyn getting together to play drawing games.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sculpture at the Texas State Fair called Big Tex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this giant animatronic man from, I don't know, like the 60s who talks to you when you go to the state fair. And we all remembered him from our childhoods. And he actually self-immolated a few years ago.
Wow.
Very unexpectedly. And it was the day of one of our draw time meetings. So we mourned for Big Tex. We all drew him on fire and said goodbye to him. And there is something, yeah, I guess maybe it's kind of silly about people from Texas. Or I don't know, it's it's so big, it is hard to feel like you're at the center of things or that you're important. So I think that growing up there, you have a pretty strong sense of futility and the absurdity of things. And, you know, there's an element of boredom, maybe.
Right.
I was just watching Dazed and Confused. It's like, that's really, you know, we drove around in our car for fun on the weekend.
Sure.
And we tried to find something. And I just can't even imagine what it would be like to grow up in a city and, you know, get to go to bookstores or shows on the weekend. It's just, that wasn't a part of my life. So we kind of had to create our own.
Didn't you have
comfortability?
Not to take the piss from your vision, but didn't you have bookstores in Dallas?
Yeah, we had like the Barnes and Noble, though.
Yeah, right.
I had to take a train into the city and then into Dallas, and then like go to the one comic book store that was there, and then like have them turn me away from the adult section of comic books. I might have like a Dan Clowes, like
right.
You know, something that, you know, there are things in Dallas, but they're not as accessible because everything is so spread out.
Sure. And when you're now in New York, or when earlier when you were part of that group, are you still doing that expat group?
We've kind of disbanded. I used to live in this apartment in Brooklyn. Sort of like one of those artist lofts, illegal lofts that's been handed down through groups of different artists over the years. And we had a lot of space. It was really dirty and rickety, but we had a lot of space and people were just always over there.
Right.
And it's not as easy to get people together like that.
Yeah.
when you don't have it.
Yeah.
But I'm still in touch with all of those people.
Yeah, I was just following up on the coming back together, you know, feeling sort of overwhelmed, the futility, as you put it, you know, of this giant space and then kind of going to this really crowded place and the groups of you coming together.
Yeah, I think that when you're in New York and you meet another person from Texas, there's this kind of immediate recognition and connection, like, all right, I understand you. And we do tend to kind of help each other out. My first job, my first apartment, like all these things came just from friends from Texas.
Right. That's right. The Texas mafia.
Yeah.
Totally.
We're taking over. Yeah.
You've been taking over for decades. So, you know, I was thinking back to the fact that you lived back at the beginning of our conversation that you're in Manhattan, even though you're sort of at the tip of it, that something that Andrew Russeth was saying, a guest from a couple episodes before this one, roughly, who said, you know, I'm an advocate for Manhattan. There are places in Manhattan where you can afford to live for probably even less than parts of a lot of Brooklyn these days. And I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Is that kind of what part of the reason that you're there?
I mean, for me, it was more my relationship that brought me here, but I do think that is true.
Mm-hmm.
I had to leave the place that I was in Brooklyn and just looking around for something.
Right.
I feel like, I don't know if it's the cachet of being in Brooklyn now, but you are paying just as much for something that it oftentimes is in, you know, pretty poor condition.
Yeah.
And at least the buildings in Manhattan are a little bit older and more solid. But I have a few friends who are kind of like, let's keep it in Manhattan people. Actually, my friend Irina Jurek, who you interviewed, I met her through a mutual friend, Leah Dixon, who has a bar called Beverly's in the Lower East Side Chinatown area.
Mm-hmm.
And that bar is there because Leah thought that there should be a place for artists to congregate and, you know, a community gathering point that was in Manhattan. She wants to be in Manhattan. And so I have this place in walking distance from my house that kind of anchors me here and makes it feel more like a home for me.
So you've got the neighborhood bar. You're set.
Yes. Yes.
Going back to you being an artist and the, your pursuit of being an artist, it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong at all, that you work primarily with alternative spaces and maybe, you know, kind of in one of the many old sort of non-mainstream art worlds in New York. Is that fairly accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. I definitely make work that is difficult or impossible to sell.
Right.
And I like it that way.
Right.
And
why do you like it that way?
That, I just feel like it takes a lot of the pressure off for me to try to please other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many different things that you can do, and kind of letting go of worrying about if it's packaged in the right way for someone to buy it, you know, just gives me a lot of freedom. And it also has led me to work with, like you said, like a lot of alternative spaces, a lot of artist-run galleries, and it's just a lot of fun.
Right.
And it's either that or, you know, nonprofits, or I did a residency through the city that was teaching a senior citizen art class.
Hmm. What was that like?
It was great. Mm-hmm. I collaborated with this Finnish artist, and we both sort of love older Chinese people. And yeah, that's actually how we met, because I have this blog, Accidental Chinese Hipsters, that was all about street fashion for elderly Chinese people.
Right.
And she emailed me and said, hey, you know, I make art where I take pictures of old people, like, let's hang out. And we really wanted to do a project in Chinatown, but it's a hard group to find your way into. You know, they're not like the, you know, they're not the most welcoming group to just, you just walk up to someone on the street and start a conversation with them. So mm-hmm. it was actually through this nonprofit in the city grant that we got assigned to the senior center in Chinatown, and then we had an art class, and we pitched it to them, and they were very skeptical, and
mm-hmm.
you know, it took us a long time to win over people into doing what we wanted them to do, which was, we said, okay, well, it's a wearable art class, so you're going to make things that you can wear on your body, like, you know, a hat or a costume or, you know, props for a photo shoot. And eventually we got it to a core group of maybe 8 or 10 people that really, really got into it and kind of found their own identity as artists. And we had a show for them in the Lower East Side, and it was amazing. It's you know, it's a longer process. Yeah. It's not an immediate gratification.
Right. Exactly. That's a great sort of analog for art making. For a lot of us, you know?
Yeah. We have to be patient.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And that, I think, you know, but on the other hand, just to play devil's advocate, a lot of your work has a visceral and very sort of flashy visual quality to it that I would imagine, if not for you, certainly for your participants, is pretty instantly gratifying, isn't it?
That's true. I guess I was talking about this with an artist. Stina Plotnin is an artist that I've been collaborating with a lot in the past couple years, and we both love novelty, and sort of boiled it down to, we like being excited.
Mm-hmm.
And I like sharing that feeling with other people. And there are a lot of shortcuts to that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like in the service of relationship building.
Right. Right. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned a little while ago the Accidental Chinese Hipsters series that you were doing, because we were going to talk about that. I'm just going to guess, because we haven't talked about this before, and you know, I just perused through some of the images, that you, as the title very clearly suggests, you started seeing these elderly. Well, actually, elderly is, I'm importing that from the projects that you were talking about. But so you basically saw these Chinese people. I don't know how, if there was a gender tendency in that group, but the fashion that they were wearing somehow seemed very kind of pseudo hipsterish.
Yeah. So when I started the blog, I had just moved to New York, and I was subletting an apartment on Bedford Avenue in Williamsburg. And
the heart of Williamsburg.
Yeah. You know, in Austin, the uniform is basically jeans and a t-shirt. So for me to go outside and feel pressure to dress up, or, you know, just to go to the bodega, apparently you have to wear like a sequined mini dress. It was a pretty big culture shock for me. So
wait a second. Wait, before you continue, let's break that down for a little bit. So you were basically you were basically giving in to the peer pressure that you could not go out with your Texas uniform.
I did. It was also for my job. I was teaching adults, and I realized that I looked like I was 12 years old to a lot of my students.
Right.
So I had to start kind of dressing the part to get a small amount of respect. I was sort of becoming aware of fashion as self-expression, as something that you could play with. And New York is, you know, a place where people barely could care what you're doing. So you can experiment with your appearance, and you're not going to get a huge reaction out of anybody. But initially I was a little bit skeptical, and I would go to Chinatown in Manhattan, as you know, I had a job near Chinatown. So I would take these long walks every day after work, and it would calm me down, and I would feel much more comfortable there. But then I did start kind of making this connection, you know, seeing people dressed up in, like, you know, these like crazy fuzzy dress vests and lime green pants and suspenders, and
these are Chinese people you're talking about?
I saw an older gentleman in the train station, and that phrase kind of popped into my head.
And then
I started the blog only having a few images, and a friend of mine knew someone at Gothamist who said, oh, okay, I'll put it, you know, they thought it was an interesting idea, so they put it on the Gothamist website, and then immediately I was getting like thousands of people following it. Which, you know, what I didn't expect was then I would get all of these submissions really from all over the world. You know, so it's everything from, you know, people who grew up Chinese immigrants in Australia who felt alienated when they were kids, but like, you know, sending me like a cute picture of like themselves on a skateboard when they were little, or people sending me pictures of their relatives and telling me, you know, this is why my grandmother is so cool, but she's also like, look how insane she is. And you know, and then just, you know, like a lot of funny like pictures of Chinese tourists, and Chinese people are all over the world. So
what
there's a lot of variety out there.
What percentage of the pictures that people submitted to you actually fit your vision of the category of accidental Chinese hipsters?
That they had to fit the category, and then they also had to be good photos. Maybe 1 in 20.
Okay. You could do worse.
It wasn't bad. It was something I did. It was kind of like a part-time job that I had for a year.
Wow.
I would just sit down and go through my emails.
Was Gotham is paying you
about it
for it?
What's that?
I said, was Gotham is paying you to do it?
Oh no, they just wrote about it one time.
Oh, okay, and then you were on your own. So the part time was a labor of love.
Yeah, it was a part time labor of love. I eventually did put ads on my blog, so I think I made a small amount of money from that.
Right.
Yeah, it's, you know, it just introduced me to a community of people that I didn't really know was out there, and
right.
You know, there was this group of Chinese Canadian students who started a blog called Asians Not Studying with all those pictures of
me. That's awesome.
You know, like, look, they're doing something else. You know,
right.
There's so many stereotypes.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's still, you know, I still get emails today. Even I haven't updated it really in a couple years, but it's been cool.
What's your theory on, at least with the ones that you took yourself, of why they decided to dress that way or how they came to dress that way? Because was it accidental on their part?
I guess it was because there's sort of a lack of affectation. Like, they're not trying to be cool, or they're not trying to impress you, or they're not trying to impress anybody. They like what they like, and that's why they picked it.
Right.
And they're also just, yeah, they're not that picky either. Like, I think it's also just being cheap. Like, I think one thing that I do too is if it's raining, you can just tie a plastic bag on your head.
Right.
You don't need to buy a raincoat.
Have you been known to wear a plastic bag on your head when it's raining?
I've done it. If you don't have anything else, it's not bad.
Yeah, if you don't have anything else, absolutely, sure.
I have had people who, you know, I had their picture just from a submission online, like actually have their relatives track me down and say, hey, that's, you know, that's somebody that I know. And then I interviewed this one woman through her granddaughter, and she was, you know, she was very aware of how fashionable she was. She wore a lot of like chains and sequined hats, and she was like, every day you should put on something that makes you feel proud of yourself and good. I'm really, you know, I'm a trendsetter.
Right, yeah. Right. So where are you in your arc of fashion from the, you know, Austin, as you refer to it, sensibility to going, you know, being kind of baptized in the hipster or, you know, or at least the New York self-conscious fashion to now?
I have reached a nice point where I think, you know, thinking about that so much, I realized that I should just wear whatever I like.
Right.
So it's a little bit like Miss Lippy, like kindergarten teacher sometimes. lots of bright colors and patterns and layering. Yeah, sometimes I see people on the subway staring at me, and I kind of, like, it takes a minute to realize why. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm wearing neon orange, and everyone else in here is wearing black.
Right.
Okay.
That's awesome. If you don't have them already, you are definitely going to have to collect some images that we can use to go along with the podcast of you in neon orange or something of that ilk.
Okay, Al. I can probably dig something up.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Well, here's something that I want to share with you that I have thought about before, and we can either decide to go with it or we can totally dump it, and that is we could play this game where we think of artists who have used food in their work, you know, and we could go back and forth and just like kind of off the top of our heads. Maybe I've had a head start, so maybe I'm kind of cheating, but we could name people, artists who have used food. And this is using food, like real food, not painting images of food, which is many people
that's
do.
That's hard.
Yeah. So you don't have a big glossary of people who have used food with in their art, I take it.
I have names.
Okay, let's go.
I don't know how long I can play the game, but okay.
Yeah, well, let's just see if we can each get like three or four.
Okay.
Okay. I'll go first. Dieter Roth.
All right. Okay, I'm going to say one. It's not famous. Lazy Mom.
Who's Lazy Mom?
Check them on Instagram, Lazy Mom.
She's an artist who works with food?
It's a pair of artists that do really great kind of like product photos of food.
Mm, interesting. Okay. Ed Ruscha, chocolate room.
All right. Marionetti, the futurist cookbook.
Wow, good one. Good one. Okay. This is
a
New York blast from the past who probably almost nobody listening is going to be familiar with, but Charles Spurrier, who made paintings with chewed bubblegum before other people started using chewed bubblegum in their work.
I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Michelle Segre,
uh-huh.
who is someone I share a studio with, actually.
Okay.
She's a lot of bread that she paints and mushrooms.
But she uses real mushrooms and real bread?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's archival.
Got it. Okay. Well, speaking of non-archival food, there's this artist that I've been thinking about who I can't remember her name. Maybe you can help me. I think her name is Polish. I want to say like Agnes, and her last name starts with a V, but she made these dresses out of raw meat. Does that ring a bell?
Ooh. No.
Okay. Another person to look up.
There's a Chinese artist who made a meat suit for himself.
Right.
I can't think of his name right now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A Taiwanese guy.
Right. I think that was later, actually, but maybe around the same time. Got anybody else?
Does it have to be,
can be any artist that used food, real food, in making their work. Take your time.
Well, there's a restaurant food that Gordon Mata Clark,
right,
and Carol Godin had in Soho, and they had a bunch of people through there do menus.
Okay, that works. Let me see if I can come up with one more. You have another one?
Remember what I feel like a lot of people have done things with food, who are not known for using food,
right?
But then there are a lot of people whose names I probably couldn't say off the top of my head, who are doing cool stuff with food. I went to a whole symposium on food and art that actually was at SCA a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there.
What were the people who were participating or who were invited on the panels? People, artists, food people, both?
It was mostly art people, artists and art historians.
Mm-hmm.
There was this British group called Flavor Taste Nation that was almost a little bit more on like the educational side. Names.
It's hard. It's really hard, actually, because you think that you have somebody and then you realize, oh, that's actually just a sculpture that looks like a piece of bread with a hole cut in it. Or, something like that, but it's actually not. Okay, here, I have one more, and maybe you can come up with one more, too. And I regret using a famous name, but it's just what came to mind, is Paul McCarthy early, early on. And then again, in his retro, use these houses out of bread.
He also, I forget the name of the performance.
Right.
With the ketchup.
Yep, that too.
Yeah.
Oh God, please, Allison, help us not end on Paul McCarthy, please. You have to come up with somebody else.
I keep wanting to say Anna Mendieta, but she wasn't, it was just chickens, but it was going to be food.
Oh, okay. What did she do?
she did different things with like chicken viscera.
Mm-hmm.
She would just like leave it on the sidewalk in front of her house and then make a video of, you know, the reactions of people walking by.
Oh, that totally counts. Yeah, that's great. Okay. That's great. Well done.
Okay, done.
Allison, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thanks, Michael.
And we're out. All right, excellent. Thank you very much again to Allison. She was great, wasn't she? She was very sweet and enjoyed talking to her. Hope you enjoyed listening. And by the way, for all of you who are yelling at your speakers or devices when we were doing that food artist off, Jana Sturback is the name of the artist who did the dresses with meat. She is actually Canadian. She's not, and I guess that name might be Polish, but probably not. Anyway, if you have your artists who work with food, real food, that is, and you want us to know about it, do send an email or post something on social media. And that's a perfect opportunity to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support is very much appreciated. Thank you to all of you who have donated recently. I appreciate it very much. Keep it coming. Those of you who haven't and want to support the show, you can donate through the website, theconversationpod.com. You can also support the show by leaving a nice review and rating on iTunes, which is linked through the site. That will help more people find this podcast, which is always useful since, as an art podcast, it's a, you know, it's a small pickings, but there are more of you out there, and tell a friend, please. Of course, you can also follow on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And one last thing on that, if you ask to friend me on Facebook, I am honored and appreciate it. If you could also, if you have found me through this podcast, if you could go to the Conversation Podcast Facebook page and like it, that would be great too. We're slowly creeping towards 1,000, and maybe Facebook will give us 50% off an ad or something like that. So help us get to that great goal, will you? If you have not already become a fan of the show on the Facebook page, it's linked through the site as well. All right. Thank you very much again, Allison. Thank you for listening and for being here. And I will talk to you next week. Oh, by the way, you noticed that we've been doing once a week for quite a few weeks now. So good for us. Good for you for listening. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.